Welcome to week 6 of our time with How to Be an Anti-Racist. Today we're going to be chatting about chapters 12 and 13. But first, let's, as always, take a mindful, sacred pause. Just a few seconds to focus on the sensation of a really deep, attentive belly breath. Inhaling slowly, exhaling. I am turning to that simple yet very effective strategy of deep breaths very often these days as we get closer and closer to the election. I found myself breathing through a lot of the first presidential debate this week. Took a lot of deep breaths to help myself try to stay present and stay calm, and sometimes to express emotion, like a sigh or a, you know, like the breath can do so much for us, right? It can help to calm us. It can help us to move stuff. It can... It's just this wonderful tool that I have been turning to a lot. And hopefully you have been too, because it is the simplest and easiest thing always available to us. And yet it really makes a difference. So deep breaths. They're your friend. They're my friend. I invite you to keep taking deep breaths as you listen to this week's audio. And with that, let's get started. Chapter 12 is about class. Ibram starts, or this chapter is about the intersection of race and class, and Ibram explains the idea as follows, quote, "When a policy exploits poor people, it is an elitist policy. When a policy exploits black people, it is a racist policy. When a policy exploits black poor people, the policy exploits at the intersection of elitist and racist policies, a policy intersection of class racism. When we racialize class, support racist policies against those race classes, and justify them by racist ideas, we are engaging in class racism. To be anti-racist is to equalize the race classes. To be anti-racist is to root the economic disparities between the equal race classes in policies, not people." Okay, so as usual in, you know, the way Ibram explains things, that's a lot. At least for me, I had to read it a couple of times. But I think the basic gist is that anytime we make assumptions about a race class, like a poor black neighborhood, that are rooted in blaming people instead of policy, we are practicing class racism. So for example, if people talk about the, quote, culture of poverty instead of the cycle of poverty, that's class racism, right? That people are engaging in a culture that they are choosing to engage in with their individual actions that is then resulting in their life, you know, a life of poverty, instead of all the systemic, all the policy things that create a cycle of poverty that becomes hard to get out of. And Ibram's point, as it is throughout this book, is of course that it's not people's individual choices that cause their circumstances as much as it is the way policy has affected the resources and opportunities available to them. So he discusses stereotypes about the so-called ghetto, particularly the idea that it's full of people who aren't trying very hard to succeed. Ibram doesn't accept this. He writes, quote, "The stereotype of the hopeless, defeated, unmotivated poor black is without evidence. Recent research shows, in fact, that poor blacks are more optimistic about their prospects than poor whites are." Ibram also addresses the, quote, "better than" mentality that accompanies class racism. He says, "Racist black elites thought about low-income blacks the way racist non-black people thought about black people. We thought we had more than higher incomes. We thought we were higher people." And he says "we" there because he's including himself. So human judgment, man, it is so pervasive, isn't it? And I wonder, why are we so prone to comparison? Is it human nature, or is it the way we've been conditioned to think in our society? I have to admit that the me of not that long ago probably would have made a case for human nature, because it's something that I have observed quite a lot. But lately, I've tried to be much more careful about not making those kinds of assertions, because what do I know? Like, when I take in the context of, I pretty much only know North American humans and a few Chinese humans, like originating from China or from Taiwan, who live in North America. Who am I to declare that traits dominant in our culture apply to humans as a whole? I have to go around and study different cultures all around the world to be able to make that assertion, and I haven't done that. So instead, though, I think it is safe to say that, man, this hierarchy mindset where we're constantly comparing ourselves with others and coming up either better or worse is pretty darn ingrained, I think, in most Americans. I think that much we can say with confidence. And is it because of capitalism? Is it because of white supremacy? Is it because of meritocracy? So many questions. Anyway, back to the chapter. Ibram spends a big chunk of this chapter discussing capitalism, and he writes that it's impossible to know racism without understanding its intersection with capitalism. He brings us back to the history lesson he gave us earlier about Prince Henry the Navigator, and he writes, "Prince Henry's Portugal birthed conjoined twins, capitalism and racism, when it initiated the transatlantic slave trade of African people." He then gives us a short summary of the impact those conjoined twins have had since then, and then brings us to modern day, writing that in the 21st century, persisting racial inequities in poverty, unemployment, and wealth show the life work of the conjoined twins. And then he provides a series of statistics and examples to back this up. So Ibram argues that to only focus on capitalism or to only focus on racism as the route to eliminating these inequities is faulty thinking. He argues that we must understand that they are inextricably connected, just like conjoined twins, and so they must be addressed as such. We have to be thinking about solutions that are both anti-racist and anti-capitalist. And these solutions must consist of equalizing racial and economic policies. I think I need some more time to process this chapter, because I'm really very interested in understanding more about these intersections, like racism and capitalism, and exactly like how they work together. Not that he doesn't make a compelling argument, because he does, but like I don't know. I feel I want to dig into more. And I tried to do a little bit of Google searching, and I didn't find a ton actually on the topic. So there's a lot more to be developed. Although there are some college courses that are taught about racial capitalism, which sounded interesting. And then I looked at some of the syllabi. So I guess that would be a place to go for me, since I'm curious. Look at the books on the syllabi and engage with them. Anyway. Ibram does discuss different definitions of capitalism, and he talks about Elizabeth Warren and her definition of it. Senator Warren explained that, "I believe in markets and the benefits they can produce when they work. I love the competition that comes with a market that has decent rules. The problem is when the rules are not enforced, when the markets are not level playing fields, all that wealth is scraped in one direction. Theft is not capitalism." But Ibram argues that if her approach, her proposed solution to this, which is to establish and enforce rules that end the theft and level the playing field for hopefully all race classes, if that were to work, then the new economic system would operate in a fundamentally different way than it has ever operated before in American history. So he says either the new economic system will not be capitalist, or the old system it replaced was not capitalist. They cannot both be capitalist. So this brings us back to what Ibram wrote in the very beginning of the book, that definitions anchor us in principles. So we must start with clarity on how we're defining key concepts, because everything else is built on that. So Ibram says that history doesn't affirm Senator Warren's definition of capitalism. He says that markets and market rules and competition and benefits from winning existed long before the rise of capitalism in the modern world. What capitalism introduced to this mix was global theft, racially uneven playing fields, unidirectional wealth that rushes upward in unprecedented amounts. Humanity needs honest definitions of capitalism and racism based in the actual living history of the conjoined twins. And then later he says again, capitalism is essentially racist. Racism is essentially capitalist. They were birthed together from the same unnatural causes, and they shall one day die together from unnatural causes. Or racial capitalism will live into another epoch? How do you pronounce that word? E-P-O-H. It's one of those I've read a lot more than I've heard said. Anyway, whatever that word is, of theft and inequity, especially if activists naively fight the conjoined twins independently, as if they were not the same. So thinking about this, you know, to me, it makes complete sense that Elizabeth Warren would say, I'm a fan of capitalism, but I define it this way. And instead of saying, I think we need a system, like, you know, her exact same proposal, but like giving it a different name, because a different name would like totally freak people out, at least in our culture, right? So maybe that was a calculated decision to not scare too many people away. That being said, maybe it would have been more beneficial at this point for her to call it something else entirely. Say capitalism is what we are doing, what we have been doing. My new proposal for a better economic system is whatever the name would be. I wonder what the name would be. I wonder if it already exists or if it's a completely new kind of system that needs a completely new name because it hasn't happened in history yet. I actually have a lot of questions about economics. It's something I'm interested in and would like to study more. Okay, so to wrap up this chapter on class racism, Ibram goes back to his own story, to the time after college when he purposely decided to live in the so-called ghetto because he thought that poor blacks were the most authentic blacks. I thought I was so real, so black, in choosing this apartment in this neighborhood. In truth, I was being racist, playing poor blacks cheap as human beings. While others had fled from poor blacks in racist fear of their dangerous inferiority, I was fleeing to poor blacks in racist assurance of the superiority conferred by their danger, their superior authenticity. So once again, we get this message of individuality. There's no such thing as one model of an authentic black person, just like there's no such thing as one model of an authentic white person. And to think that there is to be racist. And so he's making clear that thinking that black people are better than white people is also racist, right? He's throughout this whole book, he's saying we have to look at everybody equally and as individuals. Otherwise, we're being racist. So, yeah, that is that chapter. Let's talk about chapter 13, which is titled Space. This chapter dives into racialized spaces, and Ibram says a space is racialized when a racial group is known to either govern the space or make up the clear majority in the space. A black space, for instance, is either a space publicly run by black people or a space where black people stand in the majority. Policies of space racism over-resource white spaces and under-resource non-white spaces. Ideas of space racism justify resource inequity through creating a racial hierarchy of space, lifting up white spaces as heaven, and downgrading non-white spaces as hell. Now, he spends a lot of time talking about education in this chapter, and you know, I'm always thinking about education. So I my mind went straight to schools even before he started going into it. We all know that schools where white kids are the clear majority tend to be better funded than schools where black kids are the clear majority, or where Hispanic kids or Latinx kids are the clear majority. And race class applies here too, right? Because if we look at the resources given to public schools that are filled with mostly wealthy white students compared to the resources given to public schools that are filled with mostly poor black and brown students, as well as the other ways the inequities between the two tend to play out, like how many more parents are involved in volunteering and donating money and so on in wealthy white schools compared to poor schools with more higher minority populations. And of course, this has nothing to do with, like, you know, if there's a thought like, well, the wealthy white parents care more. Well, that's bullshit, right? We know it has to do with the resources available to them. Because of their wealth, they probably have more time to engage with their child's school than somebody who has fewer economic resources does. And so then you add it all up and surprise, the kids at the wealthy white schools have better academic outcomes, which now ties back into Ibram's points about space racism, because the academic outcomes of all the other schools are then measured on a hierarchy of how well they're performed in comparison. So like up at the top, you know, the top of the mountain or the top of the highest standard is basically what the school is full of wealthy white kids. How are those kids performing? That becomes the standard that everybody else is measured by. That's a problem as we start to look at this idea of space racism. And especially, you know, that concept built on everything else we've been learning about in this book. And education, what I'm seeing recently is that education is beginning to catch on and start to do things differently. Denver Public Schools recently announced they're going to get rid of the way they had been rating schools, and they're going to do it differently because I think, you know, I think that comes from the recognition that, yeah, the way we were rating schools before was, I mean, I haven't seen anybody say it's because of space racism, but we can see all, like, the more aware of these things you become, the more you're like, oh, yeah, that's a problem. I think we need to do that differently. So Ibram writes about the familiar weapon safeguarding space racism, which is unfairly comparing black spaces to substantially richer white spaces. Comparing spaces across race classes is like matching fighters of different weight classes. So that just sums up all the stuff I just said about education and the way schools are measured. Excuse me. I wonder if we could, wouldn't it be cool if we could, I think all the time, like, what if I could go into the future? I mean, it'd be kind of terrifying. I don't know if I would actually do it given the option, but if I could travel like 20 years into the future, I don't know, 50 years, 100 years, I would want to, I'd look at a lot of things, you know, there'd be so much to learn. Like, where did we go? And one of the things, if I was able to, I would look at is be like, how is education working now? Has it gotten better? And you could almost just go there, you know, and not even look at all the other stuff. And I think feel like that would provide a pretty good sense of how much progress or not that we've made. Okay, so Ibram also shares about the time in graduate school, when he was in graduate school, when an interaction with a black classmate forced him to look at his own space racism. So the student had initially attended a primarily white university. He was a black student. And when she attended that university, a financial aid officer stole thousands of dollars from her. Blows my mind. How does that happen? But she still held that university in high regard. And then she attended the same historically black university that Ibram did, Florida A&M, and she claimed to hate it because at one point they made a mistake on her transcript. So when Ibram heard this, he realized that I could not be angry at her without being angrier at myself. How many times did I individualize the error in white spaces, blaming the individual and not the white space? How many times did I generalize the error in the black space, in the black church or at a black gathering, and blame the black space instead of the individual? So once again, we are seeing the racist idea perpetuated in so many areas of our society that white people get to be individuals while black people are viewed as representatives for their whole race. So Ibram then goes on to look at the history of space racism with a focus on education and the impact of the Hallmark Brown v. Board of Education case in 1954, which ruled that racial segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. So while this ruling is a very big deal in the history of race in our country, it certainly didn't solve the problem of racism. It just said, okay, we're not doing segregation anymore by law, but we're still racist. Now we're just going to practice space racism. And after Brown, the integrated white space came to define the ideal integrated space where inferior non-white bodies could be developed. And the integrated black space became a de facto segregated space where inferior black bodies were left behind. And Ibram quotes Barack Obama, who wrote that the minority assimilated into the dominant culture, not the other way around. Only white culture could be neutral and objective. Only white culture could be non-racial. That one I feel like I can understand so much better because of white fragility. Like the way that Robin really challenged us to look at white culture as not like the non-culture, like it doesn't even exist. Oh, no, it's a thing. I just couldn't see it. Now I can, right? And now I can see this idea that so many white people carry that only that white culture is non-racial. So Ibram finishes the paragraph with by saying that integration into whiteness became racial progress. And I read this and I started wondering, you know, how after Brown v. Board, they started busing black kids into white schools because of exactly what Ibram's talking about here. What if they had done the opposite? Like, I mean, it never would have happened with the thinking of the day, but it's kind of an interesting thought experience or experiment. what if they had bused white kids into black schools? I can't help but think, wow, it would be interesting to see how that would have played out, because I bet those predominantly black schools would have started getting more resources. I wonder if that would have created equity faster than what they did do, which didn't really. we can see today we are still very far from equity in schools, and most schools are still pretty segregated. Anyway, interesting question. And reading all like about this idea of integration into whiteness became racial progress, I also became uncomfortably aware of my own racism yet again, because of the belief that I've carried around that I've only recently shined a light on and began to unpack, which is that integration into whiteness is racial progress. And I very much see this reflected in dominant society as well. Like now there's so many conversations that are happening about having more people of color in decision-making roles, in boardrooms and schools and healthcare and politics and so on. But the underlying message so often is, although it's not said overtly, it's like, while we are now more willing to either warmly or begrudgingly invite you to the table, please follow the rules of dominant white culture as you do so. And then they celebrate the more diverse voices in decision-making positions, but often without the recognition of the subtle expectations that accompany it. I don't know. But then even as I say this, I'm thinking about how maybe the whole idea of having more people of color in decision-making positions could, by Ibram's definition, also be a racist idea, which feels like a hard thing to say that goes against so much of what's out there right now. But if you think about, well, because someone is black or brown doesn't mean that they're proponents of anti-racism. So maybe it's more important to have more anti-racist people in positions of power, regardless of skin color. I don't know. That's a pretty controversial thing to say. I'm not sure where I land on that yet, but it is something I will be noodling on. Okay, so going back to space racism, Ibram argues against the classic idea that the goal is to create spaces that more or less match the percentages of different racial groups in society, because in that scenario, white culture still wins. Instead, he argues that anti-racist strategy fuses desegregation with a form of integration and racial solidarity. Okay, so breaking down these terms. Desegregation, as Ibram defines it, eliminating all barriers to all racialized spaces. Then, integration is resources rather than bodies. And then, racial solidarity is openly identifying, supporting, and protecting integrated racial spaces. So, again, that's a lot. Ibram packs a lot where I really have to think about it in, you know, just a few sentences. But my takeaway is that another way to say it could be that to be anti-racist is to allow people of any race into any racialized space, regardless of the majority race in that space. And to be anti-racist is to support bringing people together, because that allows them to learn about how they are different from each other, as well as connect around how they are the same. And then, of course, an important part of it is that to be anti-racist is to give equal resources to all racialized spaces. But a big part of it is it doesn't mean we, you know, primarily Asian spaces or primarily Latinx spaces or white spaces or black spaces. It doesn't mean we mix all those together. It means we can have all these spaces where there's a dominant or a majority race is one race. And the idea is they would all be open. So if other people want to come and connect and learn, they can. And that's more valuable than just integrating. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because so much would be lost if we didn't have spaces that had majority of different races. So much would be lost. And that's not the point. Right? we want to learn about and celebrate our diversity and welcome everybody and distribute resources equally, not eliminate it so that everybody can assimilate into one culture, which is back to that idea that assimilation into whiteness is racial progress, which is a racist idea. That I'm still unpacking within myself too. I feel like that I need a little more time to let that sink in. I'm not proud to say that, but that's where I am. Okay, let's talk about calls to action. So, three suggestions for you this week. The first one is, for the next few weeks, as you engage with the news, ask yourself the question, do I see evidence that racism and capitalism are conjoined twins? And look for specific examples just to help you further develop that understanding in your mind. I'm going to be doing that for sure, because I want to go deeper into that topic. And I want specifics in our modern day world. And we'll probably get to see lots of it, right? In this month now we have until the election. Okay. My second suggestion is to ponder, journal on, or have a conversation with someone on this question. What do you imagine a world without racism and without capitalism would look like? That's kind of a yummy question, right? And for once, that lets us focus on the vision of what could be instead of focusing in on the problems with what is. And then my third suggestion is to ponder, journal on, or have a conversation with someone on this question. Do you or have you ever believed that integration into whiteness is, quote, racial progress? After reading chapter 13, how would you now define progress in terms of space racism? Okay, everyone. As always, thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. I appreciate you so much. This book club helps me to dive into every book we read much deeper than I would if I were just reading it on my own. So thank you for being here. Thank you for listening to these audios. It supports, it helps, it moves along my own learning an incredible amount. So I'm really grateful to each and every one of you. I will talk to you again next week. Mwah! Love you all. Bye.